All right, Wish, you ready for this?
Yeah.
Everyone loves a list, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is a hockey podcast, right?
Rumors. Hmm. If the rumors are true, yes.
So we had a few hockey games in the NHL over the weekend. We had some tournament games in the Memorial Cup. We had the World Championship.
I want
to ask you, Greg Wyshynski,
yes,
your top three favorite potato chip.
Top three chips. I'll expand it out to other chips.
Hold on. What do you mean, what? Expand it out to other chips?
Well, for example, like, I don't consider a Dorito a potato chip, but
why
it's
not?
Definitely in my top three. You do?
Yeah.
It's not potato-based. It's corn-based.
Oh, we're going to get that Pacific in the Atlantic? Really?
There it is.
Really?
In no particular order, right. Cool Ranch Doritos. And by the way, if you're an aficionado of Taco Bell, like your old friend wishes, the Cool Ranch Doritos taco will be headed our way at some point in the next several months. Now, the Doritos
Hang
taco
on, the Cool
itself,
Ranch Doritos yeah. taco? Like, the taco yeah. shell is a Cool Ranch?
Here's what's happened in Taco Bell, and I understand you not knowing about it, because, you know, it's good. They got a good proportion of meat there.
Mm-hmm.
They created a taco shell out of nacho cheese Doritos, right?
Yeah.
I've found it to be kind of inconsequential. It's nice to have the orange cheese on your fingers, and you eat that, and that's kind of nice. But as, like, an accomplice to the meat taste, it really didn't do anything to me. A Cool Ranch Doritos taco, though, I think will be a game changer. I think it's like, it goes like this. It goes cure for cancer.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no, hold on. Life on other planets, cure for cancer, Cool Ranch Doritos taco, yeah. Blue Jackets win the Stanley Cup, in that order.
Wow.
So Cool Ranch Doritos is in my top three. Salt and vinegar potato chips is in my top three.
Hold on.
The puckery, painful, tongue-curdling taste of the salt and vinegar potato chips.
Let's pause on salt and vinegar here for a second, because salt and vinegar is a great one. That would always make my top three. At times, it would flirt with number one, and most times it was at number one, although Dill Pickle is really the one that's got to win at the end of the day. The thing about salt and vinegar and the Miss Vicky's sea salt and malt. Do you have that stateside, Mr. Wyshynski? The Miss Vicky's sea salt and malt?
I think we do.
There are other ones that have a sea salt and malt variation to them. They don't have the exclusive domain over them, but you always knew, like, your body told you when it was time to quit. Like, I like food that where your body says, I'm going to tell you when you should stop eating these things. And that's when the top of your mouth becomes completely raw. Like, have you ever eaten a bag of sea salt and malt where the top of your mouth said, okay, that's it. I'm like Roberto Duran in 1976 against Sugar Ray Leonard. No mas. I'm done. I'm done with these things.
And I would have to say to fill out the top three, it used to be like a mesquite barbecue flavor. But I got to be honest with you, and ever since I moved to the Delmarva area, Delmarva, for those who don't know, is the Delaware, Maryland, Virginia area. That area of the world... A lot of Old Bay. Old Bay is the seasoning that you put on your crab if you're in Baltimore, in your Balmer. Old Bay potato chips, courtesy of our friends at Utz, is probably in my top three.
Hmm.
But number one by far is Cool Ranch. Number two by far is salt and vinegar.
Let's get Elena's thoughts on this one. Because this whole beginning of the program started the conversation between you and Elena. So only further we get her involved in the top three dynamic and discussion.
I really don't remember how this conversation started, to be perfectly honest.
Neither do I.
Yeah, man.
You like ketchup chips, though. That was the big news out of your contribution.
Yeah, and I threw it out there without remembering that ketchup chips really, it's a Canadian
thing. Completely Canadian thing.
Yeah. It really is. It's like, it sounds like something you'd eat on Victoria Day or Family Day.
Well, it's bizarre because...
To be fair, Family Day is an Ontario thing. That's not a Canada thing. Victoria Day, yes. It's technically, for those who aren't in Canada and who are listening, Merrick and I are working on a holiday today.
Hello.
It's Victoria
yeah,
Day.
Whatever
and,
it is.
And we're at
yeah.
work.
Yeah, it's... Uh-huh. You know, when you think about the phenomenon... Because ketchup is a condiment. So is there a creature as mustard chips? Is there a relish chips? Is there a gravy chips? Is there a mayo chips?
There is a mustard chip.
There is?
My knowledge of
chips is bad.
Yeah. So there you go. So that's my top three, and then Elena chips in with the ketchup chip.
Yeah.
And Merrick, did you have a distinct number one as far as chips go?
I used to love the Culo Ranchos that you speak of that will now wrap tacos. Mm-hmm. Those were clutch for me in high school. But I keep coming back to a good dill pickle chip. To me, is tops. Bonus if it's rippled. And then you know there were times where I had affairs with hickory sticks. It's all about the hickory sticks for a while. You know, me and Hickory kind of have a history, but sea salt and malt are the ones. See, I'm more of a. Do you remember when Hostess put out orange and grape chips when we started to get
no.
in fruit flavors?
Ew, no.
Okay, I'm really dating
what
myself.
What is happening up there?
Yeah,
what's happening up there?
It's bad.
Is Canada like a multinational corporation?
Canada's
like guinea pig
experimental
ground. Are you guys the AHL for flavors?
More like Columbus. It's like test market for everything else in the United States. I think Columbus is like the ultimate testing ground. Correct me if I'm wrong here for various products,
like,
right?
They get all the really cool like fast food stuff, yeah. Like, you know, the like Burger King's prime rib, you know, or something like that, they'll get before everybody else.
Yeah, so they can be all Columbus, like Columbus is a city where you can be smug about everything. Oh, I tried that last year. Oh, we had that last year.
Well, there
that's
you
like
go.
The hipster,
well,
hipster city for food.
When I think of experimental fast food, I think of White Castle. When I think of White Castle, I think of New Jersey. When I think of New Jersey, I think about Game 3.
Wow.
The Stanley Cup final, Eastern Conference playoffs, final series between the Rangers and Devils. So I covered it on Saturday. Couple things. First off, I've only been to The Rock twice this year. And I got to tell you, like, you're starting to. People have always asked me, like, why put the arena in Newark? Is it ever going to succeed? Is there ever going to be, like, a fan culture around there? I've said, listen, the example that you need is. The arena in D.C., the Verizon Center, which they put in a complete shithole many, many moons ago, and then a burgeoning metropolis of restaurants and bars and cool places to go and movie theaters was built around it. Now, I'm not saying the same Genesis wave from Star Trek II is going to happen in Newark, but I will say this. On top of the really cool pub right across the street from the arena that was filled to the gills with chanting angry Devils and Rangers fans before the game. There is now a dinosaur barbecue place right around the corner. You're starting to see some stuff in the area that's not like directly connected to the arena that you can go to before the game, which is great because, as I've said about Newark, it killed the tailgate culture of Devils games. Devils games used to be primo tailgate-arama, used to rival Carolina for the inventiveness and the sprawling nature of the tailgates before games in the Meadowlands. Here is the new tailgate that I saw at the Prudential Center.
Oh, I saw your picture on Twitter. It was hilarious.
Yes. Somebody got there
like
really
a
early.
A woman with a cooler?
Somebody got there really early, found street parking next to the arena, put a table down on the sidewalk, no less.
Yeah.
And then took out a cooler and then put like a monkey on top of the cooler, like a little Devil's t-shirt, and then had like really great classic rock blaring from one of the cars. That's the new tailgate. It's like someone selling fake Rolexes in Manhattan. That's what the new tailgate looks like in Newark.
Well, first of all, by the way, you dodged a bullet on Saturday.
Yes, I did. It's true.
You know why? Because you didn't have the awkward moment in the press box as accredited member of the NHL press while the New Jersey Devils score a goal.
And it's funny, like I met a bunch of other like Devils fans who also work in the media there, and they were coming up to me and being like, "How are you going to handle this?" You know, like because it's the Rangers, right? If it was the Devils and the Lightning in the final, I think I could probably compose myself. But there is a Pavlovian response that has been instilled in me for 35 years, courtesy of my father and cheap tickets to Devils games when I was a kid. That if the light goes on and the Devils start celebrating and there are sad people in blue jerseys or white jerseys, as it were, around the ice, then you get happy. Now, what happened was, and maybe this is the hockey gods smiling upon me, they didn't score at all. They had every opportunity to, but they didn't score. So I didn't have to have that weird, awkward, how do I handle it when Zach Parise scores at the end of the gold medal game regulation to send it into overtime moment. I didn't have that moment in game three. I should have, because the Devils threw everything they could at the Rangers in that game, on the power play, at even strength, everything. And Lundqvist turned it all back, and the shot blocking got better. And I know Pete DeBoer said after the game, you don't put an effort like that under the microscope and say what went wrong. When you played that well and you think you deserve to win, you don't put it under the microscope. I don't know how they don't. I mean, that's a game you win. That's a game you got to win when you play that well and you don't come away with a W.
Henrik Lundqvist, dude. It was like Mike,
it was like Mike Smith yesterday
with the Coyotes. It was like Mike Smith. Yeah. It was same thing.
Well, they played better in front of Mike Smith. The Devils, should have gotten through that D and gotten something off of Lundqvist. But I mean, if you're a player, can you just simply say, not our day, goaltender did it? Or is there a measure of pride and confidence in your mind? Like, I'm talking to Kovalchuk after the game. He's not sitting there saying, oh, it was Lundqvist. He's saying, I didn't lift the damn puck over his glove. Like, can you just explain away a loss like that as saying, hey, Lundqvist got us again, nothing we can do, better luck next time?
Said all the right things, though. Like, that's the right response for Ilya Kovalchuk. But inside, all those guys know, yep, you know what, the goalie stole one. And they've all been in games like that before. Greg, they play in front of Marty Brodeur. Do you think that any of those players have said, yeah, Marty stole one for us? Of course. That was a steal by the goaltender. Now, here comes the psychological test tonight. Because that was the game the Devils should have won. How much can you park that and stick with the same game plan that you used in Game 3 in Game 4? Because you know what worked for New Jersey on Saturday afternoon? That long pass. They dined out. First of all, they should have won the game. They carried the tempo. They carried the play. That was New Jersey's game. But the one area where they really dominated New York was making long tape-to-tape passes.
Yeah.
You know, before we talked about, you know, game two is all going to be about down low and moving different angles and not allowing them to block shots and double pumping on slap shots and all that kind of fun stuff. Game three was all about the long pass for New Jersey. And you were there. You saw it. I mean, how many times did you see like a long bomb, tape to tape, holy smokes. That was an amazing play with the New Jersey Devils.
But they couldn't convert.
Nope.
You know, Kovalchuk had a breakaway. They had a couple two-on-ones. Yeah,
goalie. You never have to be ashamed of it. If you're a member of the New York Rangers, you don't have to be ashamed of it. There's nothing wrong. You don't have to be ashamed for having an outstanding goalie that steals a game.
Yeah. That said, can a goaltender steal a power play? Can he be the backbone of the penalty kill? DeBoer said yeah. A couple of the players said yeah. They said he was their best penalty killer. He's the reason they went 0-for in that game. Mm-hmm. Margin of victory in game two was what? One goal, right?
Yep.
One goal that was scored on the power play by Ilya Kovalchuk. So when the Rangers get a power play goal and the Devils do not, in a game three, the Rangers win the game. Clearly, special teams is going to be a determining factor in these games going forward. And that's why, you know, this Brandon Prust thing kind of came and went. And I think people see ice time, and I think people see, you know, maybe he's a replaceable part for the Rangers.
Nope.
It's not like
no way,
you know,
man.
Brad Richards going out.
No way, man.
I think the real hit is on the kill, because now, I mean, listen, Stepan and Callahan are going to be able to play their minutes on the kill and do well.
Mm-hmm.
But now you're asking maybe Brad Richards to increase his ice time on the kill, and you're asking Prust, who's a damn good penalty killer, to sit for a game in a series where margin of victory could be a power play goal.
That's just it. Like, when you have two teams that are this close, that are this closely aligned, where, you're right, to your point, the margin is so slim. Like, the tiniest little budge, the tiniest little mistake is the difference between winning a game and losing a game. Like, you can't afford to have any slip at all when the games are this tight. Does it make for a great game? No, it doesn't. We're not seeing epics on either side on the weekend. We didn't see great games at all. But when the margin of error, to Greg's point, is so tiny, a thing like taking a player like Brandon Prust out of the lineup, you're right. It's not we're removing Richards. We're putting Biron in for Lundqvist, but
It's not even Hagelin.
But it's still huge. But it's still huge.
Yeah.
It's still enormous. What did you make of the back and forth between the two of the coaches?
Well, before we get to that, what did you make of the suspension?
Had to. It was a one, and I'm fine with the one.
Yeah.
It's big. Right, but I don't think it was. I don't think that was a $2,500.
No injury, no priors, still a one.
Yeah, because there was one elbow that went directly towards one head.
And all the only reason why, you see, normally if this is the play, no injuries, Eastern Conference Final, no priors for the guy, I might be apt to say a fine. But when you ding Neal and you ding Giroux, for the same kind of thing,
you have to.
You've set the baseline.
You know,
you've let these guys know that you're not going to allow this to happen.
Is this, and I'd be curious to see, this is one of the things we'll be watching tonight in game four between these two teams. You know, at the beginning of this series, how was this hyped? Like, if you looked at all the highlight previews, how was it hyped? Well, these two teams have done this before, and it's the opening face-off brawls, right? Because you want to ratchet up how these two teams hate each other, the good level of animosity. We haven't seen that level of animosity until the Prust elbow on Volchenkov. Like, the question now is, does this introduce anger into the series? Because we haven't seen it yet. We've seen clinical play. We've seen smart play. We've seen a couple of brain cramps. We've seen a couple of moments where things look like it could have maybe started to rub each team the wrong way. But we haven't seen the glorious creature we call sports hatred involved in this series. I wonder if that was the moment that hatred came into it. Do you think it is?
I'll give you two reasons why we haven't seen hate. The lack of a Sean Avery and Brandon Dubinsky in the series.
That's a great point.
Two matches to the gasoline when they play the Devils, for sure. But to answer your question about the coaches back and forth, I think DeBoer is inherently smarter than Tortorella. Like, I think he's just a smarter dude. And I love the idea of these guys sparring. Like, I love the idea of these guys sparring in the regular season where Tortorella was flapping his arms and crying about DeBoer doing exactly what Tortorella did, which is put the goon squad out at the top of the game to start a little tussle. I love the idea of Tortorella basically going down a tinfoil hat's worth of conspiracy theories about plays that were hits that weren't called.
Zubris, Strawman, Parisi, Delzato,
picks. Complaining about picks on the power play. Which is like complaining about traveling in the NBA. I mean, it happens in every game, in every situation. Complaining about picks on the power play. And I just love the idea that here is Tortorella, the raging id of the NHL, going over all of this stuff on one side of the docket, and on the other side you have Pete DeBoer, and DeBoer's answer to all of these charges, this litany of illegality that have been levied at his team's feet, his response is comical. And that's it.
And he deadpanned it too. Comical.
Comical.
Move on.
Just how great is that?
Is this going? Listen, remember at the beginning of the series, I always complain about handshakes because handshakes are there for the fans. They're not there for the players. The players, even though they'll say the right things when the microphone is on, a lot of players, I would argue the majority of players, really don't like Handshake Alley. They just don't. They feel like frauds. I will submit. Will this be the phoniest Handshake Alley we've seen in the playoffs? This might be a good question of the day. At the end of the playoffs, when you look back at it, what will be the phoniest handshake? Will it be DeBoer and Tortorella? Like, what will be the one handshake you look at and you go like, guys, don't even bother trying to play it off like everything's cool and bygones be bygones. Don't Sid, even for a second.
Sid and Giroux, maybe.
Maybe?
Maybe more phony. That's a tough call. That's a good question. We get closer to the end, we'll definitely ask that question.
I got to start warming up on that one.
The question of the day today, though, is about captains. Now, the other thing that came out of Game 3, and I was in the Devil's room after the game. I was writing off the loss after doing the game story. Zach Parise doesn't talk to the media. For the first time in his tenure as captain, and I had some Devil's writers saying to me that they couldn't remember another Devil's captain that hadn't talked to the media in quite some time, although later on people were saying that Langenbrunner hadn't, and Marty even said that Stevens didn't talk to the media every game. But he went through the room a few times. He didn't say anything. Part of it is him saying that he didn't want to say the wrong thing because he's not exactly played his best hockey in the last several games. Part of it is also the fact that his father decided to become a story during the Eastern Conference Final by discussing what a great fit Zach would be on the New York Rangers, who the Devils, of course, are playing for the right to play for the Stanley Cup. Parise's father issued an apology the day of Game 3. Parise didn't speak after the game. I don't think these two are unconnected, and didn't talk to the media. So the question of the day, should team captains speak to the media after every game? Does wearing the C obligate you to meet the media no matter how shitty your day is, no matter how shitty your game is, no matter how many times your father has said you look great on other teams? Should the captain always speak to the media? At Wyshynski, at Jeff Merrick on Twitter, hashtag at MVSW, and PuckDaddyBlog at Yahoo.com.
I think yes. I'm not sure where you are on this one, Wish, but I think yes. For the simple fact that when you are named captain, all of a sudden you become an on-ramp, or you become a liaison between players and coaches, players and ownership in some examples, and players and the media, and by extension, players and fans. Like, you become the hub, right? Like, you become that that center, that nucleus, the nerve. You become the Atlanta airport, essentially, where you can get direct flights out of everywhere. You become that guy. that, you know, that everything flows through. You become the message. You become the messenger in a lot of ways, and it goes to coaches, it goes to ownership, it goes to your other teammates, and it goes to fans and media alike. So for that reason, I would say yes. A lot of tweets we got back already said, no, not if they're going to say anything. It's kind of BS. I don't want to hear all the sports cliches. I don't want to hear the, what I call it is Sportuguese. I don't want to hear the Sportuguese talk coming out of an athlete. I'm sick of all the cliches. It doesn't matter if they speak or not. But I think just for appearances' sake, whether they say anything of substance or not, just to act as the on-ramp between the team and the fans, through the extension of the media, I should point out, I think you do need to be there and be made available.
I agree with you to a point. I think it's situational. If Parise doesn't want to talk after a Tuesday night game against the Edmonton Oilers because he's not scored a goal in 7 games, pass. Fine. That's okay. You're allowed that. If it's game 3 of the Stanley Cup, of the Eastern Conference Final, and some shit just went down with your dad involving the other team, and you haven't scored, and your team's now down 2-1, having gone 0 for 6 on the power play, and the media wants you to talk, you are wearing the C. That means something. You talk.
Yep.
But if Mark Everson of the New York Post wants to write the Parise's a terrible captain story because he didn't talk after Edmonton on a Tuesday in December, well, F him. But if you want to criticize Parise for not talking after game 3 for whatever reason, I think it's completely warranted. He has to Eliash, Kovalchuk, Volchenkov, who took a chicken wing to the back of the head, Marty, who lost to Lundqvist for the second time in the series. These guys talked. Captain's got to talk.
Yeah.
Captain has to talk in that spot.
How much of it do you think was, oh, man, I don't want to answer for what my dad said?
All of it.
The last thing.
90% of it.
The last thing I need is to talk about how my dad thinks I'd look good on the Rangers.
Yep, 90% of it.
I think so,
because he doesn't
too.
Want to give the story legs, right?
Exactly.
So I understand that. But
the thing
at the same time,
it's not going away.
Just get up there. Yeah, just get up there.
Get in front of it.
Just get up there and shut it down. Shut it down, yeah.
Get in front of it. Just get out in front of it and shoot it right down. And don't do I'm not talking about this either, because that just gives it more legs.
So there's your question of the day. We will now
holy smokes.
Transition to start the show proper.
We're done talking
as
about
we
chips.
Often do.
What are we talking about next? Candy bars? Skittles? What are we talking about?
Jeff Merrick of Sportsnet.
That's a hockey, you know. It's only a game. Why do you have to be mad?
And Greg Wyshynski of Yahoo Sports.
Sabine is not English for punch me or headlock me in a scrum.
Debate hockey, pop culture, and more hockey. Merrick versus Wyshynski.
Coming up in a scant 7, maybe 6 minutes, Liam McHugh
of
NBC Sports, NBC Sports Network, NBC's NHL coverage, formerly of the Daily Line. That's when I used to talk to Liam back when he was doing the Daily Line with remember Jen Sturger? Of course you do.
Of course. How could you forget?
How could one forget
about Jen? Hey, we didn't get a chance to have a peek at that a whole lot here in Canada. Anything that I always saw was always online. What was that program all about? And what did you do on it? Liam was like not just the host, but like the hockey guy too on the panel.
It was very much like a Fox show that you guys probably didn't see up there either, called The Best Damn Sports Show, period.
Oh, yeah, we got that. We got plenty of that.
It was like 4 people sitting around. It was good. I mean, they had some pretty good sports talk. They had some funny cats on the show. They had some good guests. Not at the start. I don't know if Liam and I ever talked about this, but they used to have a guy on the show. So it's like Liam's a good-looking dude. They had another guy who's a good-looking dude. They had Sturger, who's a good-looking dame. And then they had this, like, chubby Jewish guy named Rob the Numbers Guy. I think he was Jewish. Maybe he was Italian. I don't know what he was. But his job on the show would be, like, Liam would set up the thing. Mm-hmm. The other dude would make a funny joke. Jen would say something coquettish and really kind of flirty. And then Rob the Numbers Guy would step in and be like, hey, by the way, in case you were wondering, the Reds are at 5 to 5.5 tonight against the Braves.
It was
the opposite of good television. But they got rid of him and got back.
Yeah. There is something there, though, as a recurring character, like the Cliff Clavin of hockey trivia.
But yeah, if he's Rain Man, you have to make him really like
that's the thing.
Or touched. Yeah.
Yeah. But there's some definitely there as a character on a panel show. Absolutely. Like the fact checker. Well, actually, and that's how every sentence has to start. Well, actually, if you want to know.
Like the guy on PTI that runs all the facts at the end of the show.
Mistakes.
And tells him with it. Yeah, I like that. Like an ombudsman. But this guy was like a betting line guy, and he wasn't like if you had Rob Pizzo, our old buddy, doing the betting lines on that show, he'd do it in kind of a slick, hip kind of way. This guy was just like, you know, it was like the awkward guy at the end of the bar who's trying to tell you about Corsi. No offense to the stats community.
You mean the goalie coach?
No, that's funny.
Thank you.
The thing about the Daily Line, and I've said this to the folks that run NBC Sports before, the setup that they have now for the between period show with Liam and Mike Milbury and Keith Jones, I think works. It's very traditional. It works. It's good. They break it down. Whatever. I still want NBC to steal my idea that when you get done with the game and you get done with your serious button down wearing a tie post game show, take four guys, put them on couches, and just rap about hockey for a half hour. And just get bloggers, whoever, just get four guys in the room to say all the crap they couldn't say because they're breaking down highlights and showing you where the outlet passes came from. Just get four guys talking about hockey for a half hour every night on that NBC station. I'd watch it.
Do you think, which this is a good thing to talk
to
Liam.
But real casual, though.
Yeah.
Real casual.
See, I wonder, too, and I always go back and forth on this, because sometimes I find it interesting, other times I find it mundane, and other times I find it offensive, and we'll switch the channel. Where are you at with intermissions that focus on the X's and O's of hockey? Like, why things, like breaking it down. Here's the F1, here's what he did on this play, and here's how, you know, Quenneville's team flushed the boards and got it. Like, where are you on that? And even, for NBC as well, trying to grab a casual audience, do you think that attracts or alienates? Because I don't know. I'm too close to it. I have no clue. I have no idea.
I think it attracts to a certain extent, because even though they break down plays during the game, the ability to use the magic table, the one that they used to play Centipede on in bars, to diagram plays and show you exactly how things worked out with the magic pen, I think will help a casual fan understand what happens in a play to set up a goal. For example, if you're at the game and you're sitting upstairs, you can see plays develop. And if the casual fan is watching this game and gets a better understanding on seeing how plays develop, to see what happens away from the puck, because essentially that's what they're showing you, then that's a good thing. That said, you can have too much of a good thing. And I think NBC's failing is a little too much of the X's and O's on the game that night, and a little less than what they should do on the issues of the day. Like having their Mackenzie Drager type up there to talk about who the new coach of the Capitals is going to be and that kind of thing. Like, because I think for me as an American fan, I watch more Hot Stove than I do Coach's Corner.
Right.
Because I'm more interested in that stuff.
See, I wonder too. I wonder how much of an app, because I'm with you. I love the Hot Stove element about hockey, and I'll watch segments like that any day of the week. But I'll talk to friends of mine who are, you know, casual hockey fans, and they really don't have a whole lot of time for it. All they want to know is what's the score of the game and have the Phoenix Coyotes been sold yet? I don't want to know the specifics of it. Is it over? That's all they want to know. Is it finally done? Because they follow it on a very, very casual level. So again, this is what every executive producer is trying to figure out. And I think where it gets complicated too is, you know, when you cross the border, there's a different sort of level of discourse that I think happens. And not to be arrogant about it, but I think there's a level of discourse in Canada that can't happen when you're trying to grow the market in the United States, because you can't grab onto a United States casual market using the same type of hockey talk that you get in Canada, where you're not going to make any new hockey fans. Like, Atlanta went to Winnipeg, and you know how many new hockey fans that created? Zero. Like, you will not make new hockey fans in Canada. This is the argument against going back to Canada. You put a team in Quebec City, how many new hockey fans have you made? Zero. None. But you keep a team in Phoenix, you keep a team in Atlanta, you are growing the game, you are making hockey fans. It's an interesting dance that NBC is involved in too, because, you know, how much do you got to do two things. One, you have to satisfy those that are watching already and give them a level of information and entertainment that, you know, they have a takeaway from it. But two, you also have to reach out to a casual audience and both bring them in and educate them at the same time on a very, very base level. That's tricky, man.
Well, first off,
that's hard.
First off, put putting new teams back in Canada just means you're reacquiring those fans, and it means that you're now bleeding their
money. No, because
they never hadn't been previously.
You're taking money. You're taking the money that they are leaving on the table, but you're not making
right,
a new
exactly.
fan. It's like they stopped.
No.
Not like all those people when the Winnipeg Jets left to go to Finland, they stopped watching hockey. They didn't. You're not making a single fan.
No, but I kind of disagree with you on that. I think what you're doing is you're re-engaging with some fans that may not necessarily be as passionate about the NHL as they were when there was a team in town. I think it's fair to say, don't you?
Yeah, but I mean, I'm talking about like from zero.
I agree with you on
that.
I'm
saying like now all of a sudden all those Winnipeg Jets fans are, you know, buying every single jersey and baseball hat, and 3 years is a sellout at the MTS Center. It's a great story, and it's, you know, new revenue that they weren't getting in Atlanta that's in the league. But my only point was, you're not making a fan. Those people didn't stop watching hockey games. They just didn't have a venue to, you know, buy a jersey for their home team or go to the MTS Center and see anything other than the American Hockey League affiliate for the Vancouver Canucks.
Right. I think NBC has done a really good job in balancing it a little bit.
It's the hardest gig. It's so hard.
We talked about this a few weeks ago. The thing that Keith Jones, the hit piece that Keith Jones did on Alex Radulov,
excellent.
Was so good
yep.
because it was so not what they usually do. And, like, I'd love to see. There's a market for that. American sports fans, if you're a casual hockey fan, if you're watching NBC that night, you might not know Alex Radulov from any other Russian named Alex, right? But you know a guy in the media taking out another dude because he's not doing his job, and you love it. I mean, that's why we all watch Mike Wallace when he was alive, because he's going and he's taking out the bad guy by showing him how foolish he is on the news show. Well, there's a basic understanding of that, and that's why that Keith Jones thing was so perfect, and I eagerly look forward to NBC taking out more bad players. Joining us down the line, you know him as the host. I'm not going to blate NBC anymore because now he's here. Joining us down the line, he is the studio host for the NBC NHL coverage, both on NBC Prime and then also on NBC Sports Network. We've been dying to get him on the show, and here he is. He is Liam McHugh joining us here on Merrick vs. Wyshynski. Hello, Liam.
Hey, what's going on, guys? Long time. I'm sorry I've been putting you off. I've been
and even longer for me and you, back to the Daily Line days, sir.
That's right.
I haven't talked to you since then, I don't think.
Yeah, those are the days, huh?
You know, hey, Liam, Greg and I were talking before you came on the air here about the nature of an NBC hockey broadcast. And I've maintained it may be the trickiest job in all of hockey media. A, trying to satisfy those that are already there and already hockey fans, yet at the same time try to draw in the casual fans. The example, you know, in Canada, whether it's us at Sportsnet or TSN or Hockey Night, we're not making new fans. Those fans are already there. The example I raise is Atlanta goes to Winnipeg. Not one single new fan is created. Not at all. You've moved money around, essentially, is what you've done. But on NBC, when you go into a game or you go into an intermission, how much of the conversation revolves around, we have to do two things, satisfy the hardcores that are here and also reach out to a casual fan that we need in order to grow this game on NBC?
I think it's something that we definitely look at a lot. And I think with me, you know, my experience with the sport is, you know, I was a casual fan and then I covered all sports for years. But I certainly wasn't a guy who covered hockey every day until I really got involved with Versus and NBC. So I think that there's something there that I don't completely 100% understand. I want to make sure that we're not glossing over it. I want to make sure that, you know, guys are thoroughly explaining it. But at the same time, and it's funny because I'll get things on Twitter all the time like, hey, why don't you guys do a hockey 101 thing? Like, explain what's icing. You know, we can't go there.
Yeah.
You're going to insult people.
You
know, and I remember, you know, and I'm a huge soccer fan. I played soccer in college. And I remember watching the Champions League final last year. And they had it was on Fox. It wasn't on Fox Soccer. And they had Michael Strahan do a difference between football and football. And I remember going like, oh, my God. Like, God, I just feel bad for whoever's in charge of, like, you know, Fox Soccer Twitter right now because they are just going to get hammered about this. So
yeah.
It's a fine line. I mean, because hockey fans are devout and they don't want to be talked down to. So.
And that's what you're seeing in L.A. right now, unfortunately, is the fact that you've got all this local media that feels like they have to completely dumb down the sport. And the most offensive thing that happens in the playoffs when cities or regions that don't normally find playoff success all of a sudden have a team that's successful is they start treating hockey like it's some kind of a Klingon war exercise where like it's so alien, like we're playing Hi-Li and they have to explain all the nuance of it and introduce it to an audience when I think most people get hockey or at least know of its existence. They've seen friggin' Miracle at the very least.
Yeah, I think people completely get it, and they get the idea that and it's so comparable to other sports in some ways, where it's you have guys that are tough, you have guys that are skilled, you have guys that are a little bit of combination of both. There are parallels. You have ice players and field players. You have goalies. But the idea that they get in and they need to explain it and break it down like it is this completely foreign concept. Like, hey, the Klingon reference is perfect. It's bizarre to me. And it's not like hockey came into L.A. yesterday. Come on.
It's a 1967 expansion team, and they had the Triple Crown line. Marcel Dion was there. Wayne Gretzky with Bruce McNall. I mean, you run down the history of Los Angeles. It's quite stunning.
That said, though, Liam, like the thing about the 2012 playoffs here for NBC and for American fans and trying to reach out and build audience, all that stuff, there is the argument to be made, though, that this has been a somewhat inaccessible playoff because of all the block shots, because you've got defensive teams. The argument's been made in mainstream media, USA Today, that these kinds of places, that if you're someone tuning in to watch the Kings and Coyotes in yesterday's coverage, you might not come back. It's not exactly a sterling example of the game, though. No?
Well, excuse me. By the way, I hope that didn't come over the microphone. My dog is like throwing up next to me. He's fine. He's just this has been my glamorous day off. I did laundry and I've been cleaning up my dog puking, who has decided now he's going to sit next to me during this interview and hack up a lung. So, I understand what you're saying. But I also think, there are other things that have helped it. And oddly enough, I think we all would agree to mainstream sports fans that John Tortorella has helped it. He's helped it be accessible. I mean, I think there is something in sports now where fans need a little soap opera. They need something outside of the game to make it interesting to them. And I think John Tortorella has provided that. And you guys were talking about it before, Peter DeBoer. I think the back and forth yesterday definitely helped too. Mm-hmm. We've seen Tortorella be at times smugly succinct, and then we've seen DeBoer come back and be smartly succinct. And I think their back and forth has been excellent. I think the Tortorella, there he goes again. He's coughing up. I may have to go to another room. Problem is I'm in New York City, so I literally have one room.
In fairness, it's usually how I sound on the air. So, I mean, the listeners are not confused.
So I understand what you're saying about the shot blocking. And, yeah, I mean, it's not all going to be, 6-5 games and breakaways. But I think, if you watch a lot of the King series, you've seen a lot of scoring. You've seen shorthanded scoring. You've seen stars emerge. And certainly, for a team that struggled to score all season, it's been really exciting. But also, I think it's been accessible off the ice, and more so than I expected it to be.
Curious, Liam, since you cover so many sports and have such a wide sports background, I'm very curious about the new language of the National Hockey League, where once we called it a long pass, it's now a stretch pass, where now backside pressure used to mean, a back check. Puck management, we used to call, he made more than three passes on a sequence. And my favorite, which has popped up in the last 5 or 10 years, the half boards, which we used to all just call the boards. Which tradition does this borrow from? Is this from football? Is this from soccer? Where does this new language in hockey come from?
That's a good question. I think probably football, just because of the abundance of coverage. We get to the point where we're just constantly renaming things, just coming up with different terms. It's just people trying to be clever. B, it's the amount of people that coach it and broadcast it, so people come up with new terms. But when you work with guys like Milbury and Jonesy, you're not getting a lot of those terms. And it's funny because they'll hear people say them, and they say, why do we even say that anymore? Let's go back to what it used to be. And it's actually, in a way, it's kind of refreshing to have the curmudgeons next to you. Especially when, the original language is exactly, is the perfect description of what you saw. But it's perfect to have those two guys around. And frankly, it's been an education for me. Some of it's been you know, I mean, some of it's been humbling, but other times, you know, it's been a lot of fun. It's also, there are times I'm completely in awe, and I think a lot of people felt that way, especially, and you were talking about before, when Jonesy just absolutely tore down
Radulov. So great.
It was just incredible. And I think almost from a national, you know, from a mainstream media standpoint, that's the type of thing that hockey fans everywhere saw. But if it was football, if it was something else, I mean, it would be something that people were talking about for days because it was so dead on. And, you know, I don't think Jonesy is the type of guy who's just going to go after someone to make a name for himself. He knows, I mean, the guy wears the same jacket and tie every day. He's not there because he's not trying to make the show about him.
Does he really?
He really does.
Does he launder it, or is it just sort of like
jacket,
a playoff beard?
I don't know. and I can tell you this. The tie, you want to know why he's wearing the same tie every day? It's because he doesn't know how to tie one.
A man after my own heart. Actually, I know how to tie them, but I like to keep them pre-tied. I know Merrick is cringing right now.
it's like he's a prep school kid, and his tie's just in his locker. And he comes in every day, puts it on, and that's it.
Alex, our listener Alex writes in, McHugh is the best thing to happen to national hockey coverage in the U.S. since the Outdoor Life Network changed its name. You, sir, have been a soldier on the ground for Comcast, for Versus, for quite a while. Have you been able to take a little bit of a victory lap in the sense that the numbers have been very good for you guys this postseason? And it seems like, you know, listen, I've contributed to this as much as anybody, but it seems like the general bitching about the quality of coverage on NBC and before that Versus has significantly dropped outside of maybe people making fun of Pierre. But overall, it doesn't seem like there's a lot of people really bitching about quality of coverage anymore.
First of all, that is the greatest compliment I've ever gotten for our coverage. It doesn't seem like as many people are bitching about it. that is excellent. No victory lap. And I certainly, listen, I mean, I like to think that, you know, I think it's top to bottom. I mean, I think right from the start of the season, you know, we were going to go after things maybe a little bit different than we had in the past. I'd like to think that I at least helped that process. I think part of the reason, I don't think I'd take a victory lap anyway, but a big reason is I don't really have any time to. I'm doing this every day. It's something I'm researching every day, and then as soon as I'm done with this, I'll be on to the next sport. If I've helped make it better, that's great. I'm happy about it. You know, I'm sure we'll do something that people will complain about soon. So that's why Twitter's there.
Oh, I know. But you know what? Twitter and Facebook, now it seems as if everyone thinks that everyone has this feeling now, Liam, that everything in their life is like Facebook or Twitter, and everything comes with a like button. It seems like people walk around just looking for like buttons to push or dislike buttons to push. Hey, you know, I got to work with Mike for 4 years at Hockey Night in Canada, Millbury, that is, and I love the guy. I think he's a fascinating guy, an interesting guy, pretty generous guy too when it comes to when the tab shows up at the end of the night, I should point out as well. He breaks all the stereotypes about ex-players. I've got a ton of great Millbury stories. Which one, when I say Mike Millbury, which Millbury story are you comfortable telling on the air?
I'll tell it this way. You know, we have an audio guy that keeps track of just a lot of the things. Mike's mic, he doesn't realize his microphone's on all the time, so he keeps track of all this stuff. And occasionally in my ear, in the IFB, I'll hear, singing. And I don't know what it is, and I realize it's Mike who's singing to himself, but doesn't realize his microphone is on, and the guys in audio are loving it. They're just taking it out. They have cracks of his, you know, and he mainly sings oldies, but I caught him. This is, I guess, old too, but he sang. I couldn't believe at one point singing Jethro Tull. It was Aqualung.
Aqualung, probably, yeah.
Yeah, I think it was. But it's mainly oldies. And they play it in my ear all the time because, if I'm getting upset about something, they'll just put it in my ear and it makes me laugh. But I always think about the, whenever I hear Millbury sing, I think about the villain in Roadhouse sort of singing to himself and just driving down the street, just meandering, serpentine style. Always pops into my head.
That's pretty impressive.
Listen, next time you're on with Mike, because you'll appreciate this story. I'm not sure if I've told it on the podcast before. Ask him, because everyone, when you think of Melbourne, you think of the shoe incident, MSG. And really, all he did was take off the guy's shoe. He didn't even hit him with it. Peter McNabb got away with murder, grabbed the guy, threw him down, and punched him. No one mentions McNabb. But ask Milbury what happened when he was running the Maine Mariners of the AHL, when he tried to get at an organist in Sherbrooke. The story's a funny one, Liam. I think you'll like it, bud.
Wow.
The suspense is now killing me.
Oh, you'll like it. You'll like it. You'll like
Liam,
it.
Liam McHugh of NBC, you have worked now both with Mike Milbury and Keith Jones for so long. I wanted to ask you a series of five questions, and you tell me whether it would be Keith Jones or Mike Milbury that would best fit this description.
Oh.
All right, ready?
There is no
right answer except for the one you're about to give us. Elena, if you please, start the clock. Who would win a buffalo wing eating contest, Milbury or Jones?
I'm going Jones.
Who is more likely to have cried during Titanic, Milbury or Jones?
There's no question, Milbury. No question.
Who has been pantsless behind the NHL on NBC table the most times, Milbury or Jones?
I'm so happy to say that it is a tie at zero. I can't even describe how great it is that has never happened, even though it's now pictured in my mind.
Now, the original question here was going to be who would be most likely to pull a Lieutenant Frank Drebin and wear his wireless mic to the John, but you've already kind of answered that as being Mike Milbury. So I will change it up to who is more likely to win if they went head-to-head in the American Gladiators Eliminator Challenge?
Oof. I'm going to go with Milbury.
Whoa.
Yeah.
The fighting spirit.
Yeah, I think that's it. I feel like Jones, after a couple events, would just want it to be over.
Finally, Liam, if you hit the Powerball lottery, you, Liam McHugh, if you hit the Powerball lottery and you won enough money to purchase a National Hockey League expansion franchise, who would you choose to be your general manager, Mike Milbury or Keith Jones?
Wow. Oh, that is a rough one.
Mike would be fun. You know it, Liam.
He would be.
Mike would be fun.
You know what? I think because it could only work in this order, I would take Mike Milbury as the GM and Jonesy would be our assistant GM.
The correct answer is Jeremy Roenick. I'm sorry. That was the correct answer the entire time. Well, there you go. You've done really well in the challenge. There are no right answers, but I think that we've gotten some insight into your world, Liam. And again, thank you so much for coming on. We're big fans of yours.
Hell yeah.
And it's been too long, and hopefully we'll have you on again soon. And continued success doing your hosting thing, sir. It's been very exciting to see how your career has grown.
Well, thank you very much. It was a pleasure coming on, guys. You guys do an amazing job. I'm big fans.
Take care of that dog and say hi to Mike for me, okay?
You got it, guys. All right. Have a good one.
Thanks, Liam.
The moment when I realized that Mike Milbury wasn't Mike Milbury, if that makes sense, was at the Olympics. And we were all – it was right before the gold medal game. And we were all in this – the rest of the time you got to the arena and you went through, you just walked in like it was no big deal. Just walked in, right?
Yeah.
They check your credential. You walk in, you go on press row, and then you spend the entire day there. Gold medal game, all of a sudden there is a security barracks. It's like a whole thing. And you got there and you look and there is a line, like an Apple store line, basically, to get into this joint to get ready for the gold medal game. Just a long-ass security line. And it's to the point where a lot of the writers are thinking, holy shit, we're going to get there, and it's going to be like 10 minutes until puck drop because this line is so long. Milbury's on TV that day. Milbury gets there. He's got a suitcase. He's clearly like hitting the skids after the game, going back to where he was going to go to.
Mm-hmm.
He gets there with his suitcase, goes right to the front of the line, looks at this thing, looks at this elephantine line, and now I'm thinking, this is VIP right here. This guy's going to go right through. He's got to be on TV. He begins walking to the back of the line until someone says, no, 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 Mike, you need to be on TV in like 5 minutes. Here, go through this section here. But the dude was going to go back to the back of the line and wait with all the plebeians. And I said, That's salt of the earth right there. That was insight to that dude's makeup and personality that I did not have prior to that. And that was a moment of where I really, you know, gained some respect for him.
Always got along with Mike from when I worked at Hockey Night from day one. And we've had, you know, a couple of nights after the show, go out and I was saying with Liam Hunt, I'm being honest, like he'd be the first guy to grab for the bill. Like most guys go down and, you know, here comes the bill. Oh, I got to tie my shoes. Mike would be the guy to grab the bill. I'm telling you. He's a wonderful guy, and he's a funny dude, man. We've had some conversations. He told me once when he was running the Islanders, and many Islanders fans may throw their hands up in the air at this one. We were talking about the draft, and he said, you know what? If you're lucky at the draft, you get one kid. You get one guy that can really play for your team. He goes, as a matter of fact, I remember one time I called the St. Louis Blues, and I offered them every single pick I had in the draft for their first. And they turned it down. I said, what draft are they? He goes, I ain't going to tell you that much. He goes, but I remember I called the St. Louis Blues and I offered every single Islanders pick for their first round pick.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I say, like, hey, man, if Mike runs your team, regardless of how you feel about, you know, how he, you know, the trades that he made, the signings, whatever, it would be a lot of fun. And by the way, do you know, have I told the organist story from Sherbrooke with Mike?
You have not.
Let's wait till the end of the show. It's an interesting one because it sounds a lot worse than it is. But when you find out what happens at the end, you think like, oh, you know what? That's a pretty noble thing. But Mike Milbury tried to attack an organist. That story is coming up in a few moments.
I love stories about Mike Milbury's organist. Joining us on the line, the man knows a thing or two about Russian hockey, which means that he should be a pretty happy fella after the Russians won the 2012 IIHF World Championship over Slovakia over the weekend. He is our good friend, Puck Daddy's own, Dmitry Chesnikov. Hello, D.
Hey, guys. How are you?
How are you?
Congratulations.
Yeah,
congratulations, sir. Gold.
Well, thank you. You know, I'm especially happy for some people, for some guys on the team who won their first gold.
Hey, let me ask you a question here before we go on to some of the specifics of the tournament and some of the players and what may happen afterwards. I got to ask you, how does this happen? How is it Medvedev and Tretiak out there on the ice putting the medals on the guys? DC, and with Rene Fasel just sitting there with a big grin. How is that allowed to happen?
What do you mean?
Well, it would be like Bob Nicholson there putting the gold, like the head of Hockey Canada putting gold medals around Ryan Getzlaf had they won the world championship. It just wouldn't happen. Like, shouldn't it be someone from the IIHF? It just, I don't know, didn't it kind of feel weird to you? Like, here's, you know, the head of Russian hockey handing out the gold medals at this IIHF event. Didn't it kind of feel weird?
A little bit, I guess, but
I've never seen it. I'm sure he's a
member of the IIHF, being the Russian Hockey Federation president. But I think it was kind of strange to see Medvedev there because, you know, obviously the league and the IIHF and the Hockey Federation are sort of a little bit at odds because the KHL is now sort of leaning like towards the NHL structure. They don't like their players to leave and take these breaks, you know, and there's insurance and other things coming into play. But still, you know, international hockey, it's international hockey.
My question for you, because I didn't get a chance to ask you this before I posted on it this morning, is it Russian tradition to throw your coach in the air like it's his bar mitzvah, which was what they did with their coach? Is that tradition?
Yeah, that is a tradition. It's not just it's not just about hockey, but it's a tradition sort of in the country to celebrate something. I mean, at a wedding, you'd see a groom being thrown in the air, and sometimes not caught and hitting the floor. But it is a tradition that hitting the ice, you know, could have those players could have received their Shanaban, you know.
Hey, DC, like Billy Oletnikov almost did hit the ice. Like, he was up there and he went down. I'm like, they're not catching him. I thought for a second Billy Oletnikov was gonna lie there on the ice.
Yeah, probably there were some there, you know, or some who were left out of the squad. They're like, damn, I hope they don't catch him. maybe, you know, hit his head and change his mind in the future, include us in the squad, you know, especially the younger guys. But, I mean, they won, and this is what was important.
Before, when he headed over, obviously when Ovechkin and Semin and all those cats went over there, there were interviews done, there were things said. One of the things that got the most play was Alex Ovechkin talking about the Capitals locker room and some jealousy or whatever that was happening there. What was your take on Ovechkin's comments after leaving for Worlds?
I mean, he's not, in my opinion, he's not the one who sort of opened the doors to these comments, you know. Somebody said that the skill doesn't get you anywhere, so, or practicing saucer passes, and everybody knows there are just three players in the Caps who actually practice those saucer passes every warm-up before a game. So, I mean, he voiced his displeasure. You know, he made it was interesting that it wasn't just the people weren't really exactly asking him about the ice time, but he sort of brought it up. Even in the question about Tuukka Malkin, he still brought it up himself. So it's something that was bothering him. Obviously, he wanted it to be known. And hey, you know, if it's a game, you know, as far as the locker room politics, if players want to take it out, I mean, it's on them.
I wonder, as I watch Pavel Datsyuk set up Alexander Semin and watch that wonderful battery in the IIHF World Hockey Championship, D.C., I wonder how much of that was, I don't know if it was an audition or how much of that was, you know, Pavel Datsyuk maybe on behalf of Ken Holland saying, hey, wouldn't you like to play this style of hockey 82 games a year? When you watched Semin play with Datsyuk in these World Championships, D.C., did you not say to yourself, I wonder where Semin's going to end up next year?
Yeah, I mean, I was one of those. It's not a rumor. It's not an E5. You know, I don't have any E's. But you know, I was just wondering, you know, because someone like Datsu, you know, and Semin has got the utmost respect, and then a few interviews just going back. I don't want to look for those, but he said on the record, like, who is one player in the NHL that you would really want to play with, you know, on the same line? And it was Pavel Datsu, you know, because. They sort of, they both like the D-King and that type of thing. And interestingly enough, they never played together, right? But it didn't take them long to, you know, develop a little bit of a chemistry. I mean, considering the short period of time and, mm-hmm. and the pressure they were both under, because trust me, for them winning this thing, especially for someone like Pavel Datsyuk, who told me last month, hey, I haven't won anything for my country. It was a big deal, you know. And to do it under pressure and some with a couple of goals, you know, just like you did in Quebec when the Russians won their first in 15 years. So, yeah, it was something really interesting. And Mark Gandler said they're looking for years. Everybody knows Mark Gandler and Yashin and money is still involved. But at the same time, he still said he's looking for years. So, I mean, this is an interesting thing. And for Semin to move west, it would be something interesting. Yeah, I mean, if it happens, I would just be excited to see where this can go.
That'd be so much fun. Mm-hmm. It really would. I mean, to have those two guys in the same line. Last one for me, Dimitri, is about captains, because our question of the day was about the captaincy. What do you expect out of a captain? Should he talk after every game? Does he get some days off? I see here, that's why they're captains, is what you tweeted at us. So is that your stance, that you wear the C, you talk after a game, no questions asked?
I think so. I mean, you're the captain. You are the face of the team in the locker room, you know, outside of the locker room, you lead by example. That's what the captain is all about. I mean, it's not about just stepping on the ice and trying to score goals or play a shutdown D or something like that. You have to be that soul of the locker room, and win or lose, whether it's a really embarrassing or heartbreaking loss in the playoffs, you have to stand up and you know, and answer questions, and you know, because this is on you. It's just like anywhere, you know, the boss or a manager or something, you know, he is responsible for his colleagues, subordinates, and this is the way I feel about him, captain. If there's you know, if there's interest, if the reporters are asking, you do have to stand up and say, hey, this is what we did as a team, because I mean, this is just my view. Obviously, nobody has to agree with it, but this is the way I see it.
Last one from EDC. Netminding. Semyon Varlamov was there, hands held high, gold medal. I do have to wonder, where's Ilya Brizgalov with the program, or how does the program feel about Ilya Brizgalov right now?
Well, it's an interesting one, because Brizgalov, I mean, he took a lot of bad press this season. And he quite openly said he did not expect it. And, you know, I did not expect that he actually reads the papers. You know, apparently he does now, so probably you need to be careful. But as far as Brizgalov, you know what? I think he's still got the skill. He's still got that. You know, he can really help, and he's got more experience than, for example, Varlamov. No, I'm not condoning Semyon. You know, he's a great guy, but I think when it comes to the bigger competition like the Olympics, the national team coaches will certainly take a hard look at Ilya Brizgalov, and I'm pretty sure that he can still do it. You know, now I'm really looking forward to next year to see what he can really show up, because this was his, you know, Philadelphia rookie year, you know, which is always tough. But I think Brizgalov still got it, and he's in his prime in terms of age for a goaltender. So hopefully, for his own sake and for the Team Russia's sake, he can still pull it off.
Great stuff, man. All right, Dmitry Chesnikov of Puck Daddy.
Yeah.
You are our friend, and you are a valued member of the Merrick versus Wyshynski world.
True.
We will talk to you again soon, sir.
Thanks, DC.
Sounds great. Thanks for the invite, guys.
Dmitry Chesnikov. The question of the day was about the captaincy, and Dmitry answered it rather expertly. But we're going to ask, we asked our listeners, and this is what they said. This is from Mike.
Okay.
During the regular season, I would think speaking to the press after every game would not be necessary and probably wouldn't be as big of a deal. That being said, during the playoffs and especially the Eastern Conference Final and especially against one of your biggest rivals, then yes, the captain should be out there front and center after each game. Not showing, especially after a loss, even a particularly frustrating one, makes it look like you're a bit of a sore loser.
Ooh.
David Cicerelli writes in, there is no precedent of Parise not talking, so it spoke volumes. He's pissed, and I was pissed. I'm okay with it. You see, that's the aspect we didn't really talk about, was the fact that when you are, you know, when you can say, hey, listen, I've been a stand-up guy over 100 times this season, which is what Parise said after he was asked about it on Sunday, the fact that you weren't this time makes it stand out so much more, right?
Yeah, it totally does.
Yeah.
It totally does. And again, as we mentioned earlier, if it wasn't for what Dad said, I'm 100% positive Parise is there answering questions. 100%.
Todd Burns, only if the media asks for them. The C is the player's spokesman. Karen M., Jonathan Toews almost always speaks to the media, but occasionally he doesn't. Never thought it was a problem. Patrick Clark, yes, but there needs to be an exception for Phil Kessel if he ever gets the C or if the A's are asked to speak.
I don't know that that's ever going to happen, Patrick. Here's a question for you, Wish. How would a player be treated? Let's say it's Zach Parise, for example. How would he be treated? How would he be received if, after every game, he did make himself available, but he pulled a Tortorella?
Wow, that's a good question. The way that Tortorella's been treated, I think there'd be even more of a backlash.
I think even worse. I think he'd be pounded on. Don't you think?
Yep.
If he said, oh, I'm not going to talk about that. Now we're going to leave that in the room. You are in the room.
Yep.
Yep. I think
that's true. Be careful what you wish for is what you're saying.
Yeah.
Steve Chamberlain, question of the day. If by team captains you mean Ilya Brizgalov and by every game you refer to games which may or may not involve the Flyers, then yes. Well, no, we're not talking about Brizgalov, of course, although it would be wonderful to hear from after every game.
Yeah.
Christopher Kraft, captains should be available after every game, provided that it brings along Coke and limes. Cheers.
That would be Captain Morgan, sir.
Sean Dempsey, this is a good one. No. We're paying these efforts to skate. We, the media, the TV audience, and 17,000 in the stands, except for the blind effing refs, all saw the game. We saw it with slow-mo replays and graphics and stats and color commentary. The shit we want them to say about the game, they're not going to say it. So it's the same shit every time. In a loss, we could have played harder. We need to come back and execute better. Joe McOther team played really well tonight in a win. We could still play harder. We need to come back and execute. Joe McOther team played really well tonight. Sean Dempsey.
It's not wrong, but what happens when they do say something? They get torched. Can you believe he said that?
He's not wrong, but I, I, you see, I get what he's saying, and I get what we talked about at the top of the show about how did you term it? What was the language that they speak?
Sportuguese. Thank you.
I understand the concept of Sportuguese. I hate hearing it, and I know that it's normally what we hear in these conversations. But once in a while, and this is why the media serves a purpose, it's not as if they are speaking to a member of the communications staff. They're speaking to members of the press who are able to come at the situation and occasionally ask a probing question that will elicit a response that is not Sportuguese. And that's why you have to talk to the media. Because at the end of the day, yeah, there is an element of gotcha. I'm never going to deny that. Mm-hmm. But there's also an element of, we are trying to find out what the deal is here. And if you're a Devils fan and you're wondering why Zach Parise ain't putting goals on the board, then maybe he can give you some insight as to why that is when presented with the right question.
And part of it, too, is from a marketing point of view, bringing these guys into your living room. Not just on the ice, but, oh, there they are in my highlight package. I'm watching in my living room, and there's Zach Parise.
And especially with those dimples. Oh, my goodness. Oh, consider my ticket sold.
Renew season ticket? Yes!
If the Devils were to set up luxury suites in Zach Parise's dimples, well, then, they'd have no problem filling that building, I tell you. All right, enough of that.
That's the key.
Real quick, Kings, Coyotes, unwatchable hockey on Sunday?
It's pretty bad. It was one of those games which were, at the end of it, I kind of said to myself, I was talking to Elena about this on the way over to the program today. It's one of those games, you're on the same page with me, right, Elena? I'm a fan, by the way, about the game last night. Where it's one of those games where you can watch it, but then if you go and read the game sheet will tell you everything you need to know about the game. Mike Smith made 36 saves. Shane Doan scored 2 goals. That's the game. So, LA carried the play. Mike Smith saved the day. And the captain got 2 goals. That's what happened. Everything else was, oh man, it was a snooze. It's a bad game of hockey yesterday. That was a bad, that may be the worst game of the playoffs so far this year.
What I wish out of this series, and at least on the Coyotes side, Mike Smith and Shane Doan have got some personality, man. They're fun to listen to.
Yep.
They were really good in the postgame yesterday.
Yep.
And Doan himself has been very good after almost every game as far as being candid.
Mm-hmm.
I wish that there was more attention. And this, you know, anytime Tortorella farts, it's a headline, right? Right. I wish there was more attention given to Shane Doan saying something like, he completely dismissed the fact the Kings are undefeated on the road yesterday. They just said, whatever, they're due. And if they're not due, then we got to find a way to make them due.
Yeah,
you know, just like, wow.
I just furthermore on Shane Doan, how much do you love the way he's playing? How much you love the way 11 hits, focus on the 2 goals, sure. Some will say, ah, I took 2 penalties, bad for the team. But 11 hits.
Yeah.
And
doing the thing where, like, you know, like sometimes you hear teammates give lip service about their star players or their captains and be like, oh, they certainly set the tone for the game. But when they say that about Doan in a game like that,
yeah,
like, you can tell that they're legitimately saying, this guy, we were in a cave, and this guy found a flashlight and got us the hell out of the cave. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it was that level of appreciation for him setting the tone and scoring a goal and just playing that type of game to really allow them to follow the leader.
And you love it when someone marries a high skill set offensively with just being a punishing body checker, too.
Yeah.
Right? And the Brandon Morrow comes to mind right away for the Dallas Stars. Oh, there's that number 23 on your team who's pretty good at it too, Greg Wyshynski.
Uh-huh.
But
yep.
It's one of the reasons why I keep coming back to maybe my favorite hockey, my favorite line in hockey ever was a junior line with the Kamloops Blazers. It was Darcy Tucker in the middle, Jerome McGinley on one side, and Shane Doan on the other.
Yep.
Put that line in the NHL of physicality and skill, raw on both sides. It's my favorite line. Might be my favorite line of all time.
And I love watching guys like that. Primo was like that, or at least he was for at least one playoff for the Flyers.
Oh, man. Remember when he dismantled Franzen's Toronto like single-handedly?
Yeah.
Single-handedly took them apart.
I love guys that are like power forwards that can lead the way, both physically, scoring. It's just they're not the stars, right? But they're the guys that are the spine of their teams, and it's just great to watch. All right, that's the show for today. Prediction for Game 4, sir?
Devils.
Yeah, I'm saying Devils, too. I think the Rangers are an every-other-game kind of team. I think without Prust, maybe the Devils get a power play goal. Might be the difference. As long as Listen, every time I see 30, I think it's a time bomb. I'm a believer. He's playing extraordinarily well, but it's always in the back of my mind. I'm going to say, could this be the one where he gives up two softies and screws him? But you know, he's not. He's earned the benefit of the doubt. But I think Devils win game four, push it to five in a 2-2 series. That is the show for today. I'm Greg Wyshynski of Yahoo Sports.
It's a demi-demi series, right? 50-50, ping-pong series. So, yeah, Devils win. We go back to MSG for Game 5. Jeff Merrick here from Sportsnet. I will be on the desk tonight with Doug McLean and Brad May. Oh, by the way, I'm supposed to go for a run with Mady at the end of the podcast today. Bailed on me, Wish.
Oh, no.
I know, and I was planning, like, okay, when do I put a pace on him? When do I really make it burn for him? No, he golfed today. He golfed today.
He's pooched
me for. Oh, I know. Golf's tough, eh? Yeah, I know. Here's a guy who played like 20 years in the NHL. Like, fought everybody. Worked out all the time. I'm bagged from playing golf today, bro.
I drove up and back from Jersey, so a couple recommendations. First off, if you don't listen to Mark Maron's podcast, download the one where he talks to Wayne Coyne of the Flaming Lips. Very good episode.
Hey, I wanted to download. Did you hear the one with Jeffrey Tambor?
Yes.
Is it good? Please say yes.
It's very good.
Okay,
but
I downloaded it.
Very sardonic. It's
awesome.
Very entertaining. If you don't listen to the Nerdist podcast, download the one where they talk to the Zucker brothers and Jim Abrams and Robert Hayes from Airplane. It's fantastically good. If you don't listen to Kevin Smith's podcast, download the one called Fat Man on Batman. Because he talks to Paul Dini, the creator of the Batman the Animated Series. And if you're a fan of Batman the Animated Series, this is like eargasm. It's so good. And the final thing I will say is that if you're a fan or a lapsed fan or an if you appreciate the band Garbage, the latest album is very, very good. It rocks very hard. But buy the deluxe edition from your friends at iTunes. Don't get the normal one because the deluxe edition has some B-sides that inexplicably aren't on the album. Like, I love the B-sides so much that it didn't even occur to me that they weren't on the proper album, but they're not. So buy the deluxe album.
Is this produced by Butch Vig again?
I think it might be.
Dude's a genius. Dude's awesome.
Well, he is a genius, but I'm not sure if he had a hand producing.
He's still
a drummer.
Okay.
So you know he still had a guiding hand on it, but I'm not sure if he's the direct producer on this one or not. But yeah, the Garbage album is real good. Finally, Blue Line Ninja. Hey, what about Milbury and the Organist? We'll do that later in the week. Stay tuned for that story.
All you need to know is Mike Milbury tried to attack an organist, and I'm guessing everyone listening to this podcast would defend him for doing so.
Okay. Later in the week, we'll do it. Later in the week, we'll take care of that. Yeah. But all right, that's the show for today. Thanks, everybody. Thanks to Liam McHugh. Great interview. So happy to have him on.
Yeah.
We'll have him on again. Thanks to Dimitri for his insight. And thanks to Elena behind the glass for being at the ready, not only with her favorite type of chip, but also for the countdown clock. Exactly. She yeoman's work today, Elena.
Yeah.
So there you go.
All right.
See you tomorrow,
man.
Folks. Let's go Devils. Bye. Thank you.